Good evening and welcome to Behind the News from May 5, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. May 5, of course, Cinco de Mayo. Happy to all you Mexican folks out there and folks who like you. It's also the birthday of Karl Marx, who would be 187 today. It's also by pure stroke of randomness, the 63rd birthday of Tammy Wynette. And tomorrow is Sigmund Freud's 148th birthday and George Clooney's 43rd, yoking the sublime and the ridiculous once again. And we've got a couple of guests up tonight. First, in about 7 minutes or so, we'll be speaking with Isha Pandit, who is a reproductive rights activist based at Hampshire College for their Civil Liberties and Public Policy program. She will have interesting things to say about broadening the focus of the reproductive rights movement beyond its rather narrow focus at the moment. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Ian Williams, a British journalist, although now living in the United States, and I believe even an American citizen. But we'll be talking to Ian about what's going on with the United Nations and also what's happening with the British elections, which I think we should be getting exit poll results at least any minute now. Polls closed in Britain just a few minutes ago. So how big a majority will Tony Blair and the Labour Party get? Will he be spanked for supporting George Bush's war or not? And how badly? Some of the economic headlines before we get to the interviews. First of all, the usual weekly tally of first-time claims for jobless insurance, unemployment insurance. People who just lost their jobs and sign up at the unemployment insurance office for benefits. That, a very timely, sensitive indicator of the labor market, up 11,000 last week, following upon a 23,000 gain the week before. The four-week moving averages, which is what most people look at, to smooth out some of the week-to-week volatility at 322,000. This has been bouncing around a lot, trending irregularly downwards over the last 6 or 8 months, but the last few weeks have seen a bit of a bounce back, and it suggests a job market that is in improving, but still not extremely robust. We're going to get, tomorrow morning at 8:30, we'll be getting from the Bureau of Labor Statistics the monthly employment report, which will give us a tally of how many jobs are created and lost in the U.S. economy and what's happening with unemployment and related such things. Most analysts are looking for an okay report, but not a gangbusters one. I'm looking for a little bit less than that. Okay, but a little less okay than the consensus. Again, a picture of a job market that is expanding, but not expanding rapidly. Monthly average over the long term has been about 220,000 to 230,000 new jobs a month. We've been averaging about 170,000 over the last several months and looking for something in that neighborhood again tomorrow. Good, but hardly great. And in past expansions, we've seen the equivalent of 300,000 and 400,000 a month job gains. We haven't really seen much of anything like that in the last couple of months. Very isolated ones, so not any kind of sustained performance like that. This is the, by measuring just by that most orthodox of indicators, GDP growth, this is the second weakest expansion of the post-World War II period. It looks to me like still we have a fairly underlying troubled tone to the U.S. economy. Fairly troubled underlying tone, if I get my syntax straight. Productivity, the Labor Department reported today, that is how much workers can put out in an hour of work, rose by 2.6% at an annual rate in the first quarter of this year. That's slightly above the long-term average, but slightly below the big numbers we saw in 2003 and 2004. for a rare moment, real wages actually almost kept up with productivity, rising at 2.4%. But that measure includes fringe benefits like health insurance. If you look just at direct pay, that's barely going anywhere. So this pattern of productivity rising as wages stagnate continues, which is very good for corporate profits, but not so great for workers. A couple of surveys from the Institute for Supply Management, purchasing managers, people who buy things for large corporations and so have a very good sense of what's going on with their business. In the manufacturing sector, that fell, it was reported earlier this week, fell by a couple of points to 53.3. Any reading above 50 signifies an expanding manufacturing sector, but he's been falling fairly steadily over the last year, from 63 about a year ago to 53 now. The employment component also down for three consecutive months in manufacturing, now just barely above 50, so it doesn't look like we're seeing any kind of expansion, aggressive expansion in the manufacturing sector, either in productivity or production or employment. The ISM also does a survey of service industries. That also declined in April, but it is close to 62, well above 50, and signifies an expanding service sector. But it, too, saw a decline in its employment component to a mere 53. Over the last 2 months, it's fallen very sharply, one of the sharpest falls in that component in the index's history. So it's suggesting the job market not so hot in the service side either. And that weak job market, one of the reasons that the ABC Washington Post Weekly Consumer Comfort Index, a measure of consumer attitudes, falling again last week to minus 19, about 8 points below that series long-term average, and a very sharp drop from late last year when it was above average. The high gas prices and weak job market seem to be weighing on consumer sentiments. Also hitting George Bush's poll ratings, high gas prices and a weak job market. His approval ratings on the economy are quite poor. But despite gloomy consumers and weak job market, chain store sales, that is the sales at big department stores and other chains, up 2.2% from last year, according to the International Council on Shopping Centers. But interesting pattern underneath that number. That's not such a great result, by the way, as slower than the first part of the year. Certainly positive, but still slower than the early part of the year. The standout sectors, luxury retailers like Neiman Marcus and Tiffany's, and warehouse clubs like Sam's Club. So it's a real bifurcated economy. If you're at the elite level, you're doing quite well and shopping to show it. But if you're at a less elite level, you're trying to save every penny you can. And that seems to characterize the U.S. economy these days. And then finally, the Mortgage Bankers Association, their weekly measure of demand for mortgages rising last week. Both the new purchase and also the refinancing. And as I've said many times here, those refinancings usually come with people taking out some fresh cash against the appreciated or allegedly appreciated value of their house and then spending it. One of the things that's kept the U.S. economy going, despite a weak labor market, that trend seems to be continuing. And also few signs of a let-up in the vigorous housing market. So that accomplished, let's take a little musical break. Dmitry Shostakovich, and we'll be back to speak with Isha Pandit. And we're back now as a bit from the Dmitri Shostakovich 8th String Quartet performed by Sorel Quartet, and we'll hear an orchestral version of that snippet a little bit later. And now we're joined on the line by Isha Pandit, who is the Associate Director of Programs at the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program of Hampshire College, based in Amherst, Massachusetts. And the CLPP works with activists to advance an organization that trains, educates, and inspires new leaders, organizers, and supporters nationwide in the cause of reproductive rights. And Isha, before directing CLPP's project work, was at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and Amnesty International's Women's Human Rights Program. Welcome to WBAI, Isha Pandit.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So the reproductive rights movement is not doing so well in the polls. It's not doing so well in a lot of political campaigns. It just doesn't seem to be thriving these days. So what's wrong?
Well, I think, we get that, especially since after the election, we heard a lot of talk about this question of morality, and one of the foremost concerns in this was abortion and the issue of reproductive rights. And the way that we, you know, at the Civil Liberties Program choose to kind of conceptualize that problem is not necessarily that the problem is that people think that abortion is necessarily immoral. I mean, 4 out of 10 women in this country have had or will have an abortion. So it's definitely very common. And our response to such sort of posturing is to kind of really question the traditional frameworks that the reproductive rights movement has used, and to really broaden the scope of reproductive rights. If you'd like, I can talk a little bit about what I think.
Well, first of all, how are you characterizing the traditional framing of the reproductive rights movement as used?
Yeah, so the traditional sort of choice framework, choice posturing, terms like pro-choice and pro-choice activists and things like that. And the reason that we find that sort of language problematic sometimes is because we conceive of reproductive rights as a much bigger issue than just just the access to an abortion. And I think that's really where the right wing has really succeeded in framing our issue for us, and we've sort of let that happen. And so our work is really geared towards challenging that sort of that idea that reproductive rights really is just about the access to an abortion. And I think the way that we can conceive of it is by trying to link reproductive rights to other movements. I often use the example of immigration. So women who come to the United States as immigrants have really specific reproductive rights concerns. Many of them don't have access to reproductive health care. Those that fear deportation often hesitate to seek medical assistance when they need it. And this is medical assistance that's not specifically limited to an abortion, just care in general, health care in general. And the matter's really further complicated when we consider issues like the power that state structures have over women who are immigrants. And so we kind of see that so their accessing their reproductive health care rights is very intrinsically tied to their economic issues. So what I've done, just by giving you that example, is linked reproductive rights to immigration, to health care, to economic justice, to racial justice and domestic violence as well, because women who are immigrants often fear deportation if they report domestic violence. And we see all of those issues as being directly tied to a woman's reproductive justice and reproductive access.
What about women who aren't immigrants, who are greater in number?
Yeah, absolutely. So those sorts of concerns, access to health and access to health care, are the concerns that really dominate women's reproductive choices, whether they have, I mean, for many women, especially, and this is where I think, per your question, where the traditional reproductive rights choice framework has failed a lot of women, specifically poorer women or women of color, because if you don't have healthcare, or you don't have the money to seek services like an abortion, the choice framework really doesn't resonate with you. If you don't have access to the services, regardless of wanting to exercise your freedom of choice, it doesn't really mean anything to you. And so being pro-choice then is only significant for women in society whose choices we already seem to value.
Choice is kind of a magic word in American life. So
right.
You think they're trying to tap into that by just narrowing it down to just a matter of almost like a consumer choice. Is that what the rhetorical strategy is?
Right, because it then becomes about who has the power to exercise certain social capital, right? You know, you want to have it be economic capital or social capital. You can use that sort of analogy. And so it definitely is very much linked to, you know, the value we place on certain women's reproductive lives, and other women's lack of access to those things then falls by the wayside by virtue of the framework we're using. Whereas if we use an access framework or a health framework, all of a sudden reproductive rights is much more than just access to an abortion, and it incorporates economic justice and racial justice as well. And then I think, in the very first question you asked me was what went wrong, I think that's precisely where it went wrong. You know, we sort of wound up focusing on this one particular issue that doesn't resonate with a lot of folks. And then so, you know, we're organizing around this idea that leaves many of our constituencies pretty much out in the cold.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who might agree with a lot of the broader social justice issues, but just find abortion itself morally objectionable. How do you react to that kind of position?
Yeah, I think once again, I mean, the folks that we work with that work directly in abortion services say things, you know, one of the most common things we hear, and one of my colleagues often says, you know, there's this perception in society that there are, you know, women who have children and women who have abortions, and doctors will tell you that it's really the same women at different points in their lives that need those services. So that's the first element of talking about, you know, people who think, you know, are opposed to abortion. It has really been highly stigmatized, and we really want to counteract that with this work as well, not necessarily to just say it's not about choice, you know, but to really counteract that kind of thinking that, you know, abortion is there's only certain types of women that do it, and it's only in certain situations. And then I think with that messaging, broadening that message and that reality actually will, I believe, really affect the way people think about it. You know, if it wasn't such a taboo to talk about, we would all know about many more women who have had, who have needed such a health care service.
I'm speaking with Isha Pandit, who is the Associate Director of Programs at the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. It also seems to me that the reproductive rights movement has been very focused on lobbying and litigation and not doing much popular organizing. Is that your impression?
I think at different times it's been different. And currently, you know, I don't even know quite what to make of the current political framework. We see folks that have traditionally, you know, in D.C. who have been, you know, supportive of women's rights now, sort of, you know, thinking that this is a moral hot-button issue and taking different stances or faltering. So I really think it's very much about linking, you know, the access to an abortion as a very specific and tiny component of a broader issue of, you know, really health rights and access to health services and physical autonomy that, you know, we don't necessarily seem to think of abortion as that sort of issue.
I would imagine that a lot of very traditional men and even some traditional women would think that control of reproduction is really a very, very fundamental issue, mm-hmm. and that the abortion, you know, as important as the broader issues are, abortion itself is also quite an important thing. For a woman to have the choice of whether to have a child or not is extremely important. How do you fit that into this the larger agenda you're trying to?
I think one of the things we've seen recently in sort of the news and more issues about reproductive rights sort of come up with these the so-called partial birth abortion ban and then the Unborn Victims of Violence Act and these fetal rights legislations that have been circulating. And the idea behind those is to remove autonomy from a woman and place it onto a fetus. And there is, quite honestly, there is quite a bit of debate within the reproductive rights movement as to how to deal with those issues and how to deal with those challenges. But broadly, there's definitely consensus that, take, for example, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which, you know, you can be, Lacey Peterson case, where you can be charged with homicide for killing a pregnant, double homicide for killing a pregnant woman. Whereas on the books, there is currently a Violence Against Women Act that many folks, you know, are not focusing on that would prevent, that would have, in effect, take care of the issue of violence against pregnant women. But however, that plays into a very different agenda. And that supports women's rights to physical autonomy. And so that's the one that's, you know, being sort of shuffled aside while we're focusing on this unborn victims of violence legislation, which definitely takes the focus off of a woman and places it onto this conception of what a fetus is and what rights it has.
Yeah, the right has been very successful at using, you know, what used to be called during the Cold War days, salami tactics, one slice at a time, to chip away at abortion rights. So you've got, you know, this, the partial birth thing, the unborn victims thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just one thing at a time that, you know, in isolation might appear superficially reasonable to a lot of people. How do you respond to these tactics?
Really with, I mean, I've been saying, we've been talking about it frequently, really with a lot of honesty, you know, sort of thinking about what really is happening in women's lives and what really do they need, and will such legislation in effect protect women from violence, and protect women's health and access to health, and, you know, sort of examining those kinds of things and questioning motives for such legislation, and using our messaging to do that. You know, we often talk about how the term pro-life is quite misleading. You know, we really are activists here who are advocating for women's lives. And that's part of the reason why the march that happened last year in Washington was called the March for Women's Lives, because it's really how we see our work as sustaining women's lives, and to sort of challenge some of this use of language that has seemed to really infiltrate and resonate with people.
Yeah, that language is very powerful stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, pro-life can actually sort of become a sneering term of abuse at people, but
right.
On the other hand, you know, this stance that you're protecting life, or the culture of life that Bush and the people around him like to use. What kind of language are you proposing to challenge or replace that?
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't want to be pro-life, right? You know, who doesn't want to
I don't know, Donald Rumsfeld, maybe.
Right, so that's exactly our messaging, is to sort of first point out the hypocrisy in some of these claims to life, and then secondly, to claim our own work and really just talk about what we really are trying to do in terms of protecting women's lives from respective things. And I'm a firm believer in using the health framework and talking about women's reproductive choice as a health care concern and a health right, not just the right to an abortion, but the right to have a healthy child and to have the ability to choose when you have that child and to maintain and sustain a healthy family.
Well, how do you respond to people who really passionately believe that abortion is murder?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those questions where for many folks, I think, you know, there's a lot of gray area around how people conceive of it. And with new genetic technologies and genetic issues coming up, people are really sort of questioning where they fall on these lines. So I don't think that that's a huge number of people. And honestly, I mean, I think we talk about sort of thinking about what lives you're valuing and how, and whose value is being placed on which lives and when, and really asking that question of people and asking them to think about that. But, you know, at some point there's no reasoning with some people, especially those that are particularly militant and fanatic and willing to kill people for that point of view. And that isn't necessarily
so great is their commitment to life, they're willing to kill people for it.
Right, absolutely. And like I said, you know, it's somewhat about pointing out the hypocrisy of statements like those, and the hypocrisy within that movement that calls itself pro-life, yet is really willing to, you know, disregard many people's lives in an effort to achieve what they term pro-life policies.
So say a few words about the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program at Hampshire. What do you do?
We have a few different programs, and our work is really about broadening the scope of the reproductive rights movement, both by incorporating other issues such as, you know, broadening the choice framework, incorporating issues within the reproductive rights movement, and also linking our work to other movements. And we have a national conference every year in April. This year we had over 700 people come to Amherst, Massachusetts. And we, you know, we have tons of workshops, and we really spend some time thinking about these issues and linking them with other, we have, you know, activists. It's an activist conference, and many students from all over the country come. And people really talk about how to link reproductive rights to other movements. And we also have a Day of Action event that happens in the fall. So our conference is our large event in the spring, which is really about education and building movement in that way. And then the Day of Action is a chance for all of our campus constituencies to act in solidarity on one day and do whatever actions are relevant in their communities to discuss reproductive rights. And that day is October 20th, 2005, this year. And there's lots of information about how to be involved with all those are on our website.
And what's the website?
It's http://clpp.hampshire.edu.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us, Isha Pandit.
It was great to talk to you.
Isha Pandit is the Associate Director of Programs at the Civil Liberties and Public Policy Program, Hampshire College. And that website, again, clpp.hampshire.edu. And let's take a little break, and we'll be back with Ian Williams.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
And the show's Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and let's take a radical shift from Iggy Pop to a little bit of Shostakovich's Chamber Symphony to set up Ian Williams. And that was an excerpt from the beginning of Shostakovich's Chamber Symphony, which was an orchestral version of the String Quartet No. 8, which we heard from a little earlier in the show. And now we're joined in the studio by Ian Williams, a veteran and prolific journalist of British origin, who will be here to comment, among other things, on the British elections. But also, Ian has spent a lot of time around the United Nations, former head of the UN Correspondents Association, so he knows that building, which is a mystery to many of us, but he knows it well. Welcome to Behind the News, Ian.
Good to be here, especially away from all that asbestos in the old UN building.
The UN is a lot in the news these days, and I frankly don't understand the oil for food scandal and Kofi Annan's relation to that and Kofi's son and all this business. So could you give us the briefing on all that?
Well, the first question is there a real scandal? Because I was on a show, I was on, I think it might have been the O'Reilly Factor. I was doing so much fox over this issue, you know, fox hunting. And Charles Krauthammer, that well-known Titanic intellect of the Washington Post, declared that this was the biggest financial scandal in the history of the universe.
Gosh, bigger than Enron or Ponzi?
Bigger than Enron,
or
bigger than the savings and loans scandal, bigger than the teapot, the dome, the South Sea bubble. And what basically they have done, and very successfully, is to take any money that Saddam Hussein got in any way whatsoever, from the first Gulf War to the second, and blame it all on the oil for food scandal. On the oil for food program, which then you blame on the UN, and then by extension you blame on Kofi Annan. And it only occurred to me a few weeks ago that basically, if you remember the one of the ways that 70% of Americans were persuaded that Saddam Hussein was behind September the 11th was just this juxtaposition of images. It wasn't rational arguments. It was a picture of Saddam Hussein, a picture of Osama bin Laden, a picture of the burning towers, and on the top, war against terror. That was all it took, repeated night after night on news, to get 70% of Americans believing that he was directly tied to this. And what they've done here, a picture of Kofi Annan, oil for food, Saddam Hussein, billions of dollars. You know, they haven't quite blamed him for the World Trade Center yet, but it's there lurking in the subconsciousness of many of the people.
He's one of the suspicious foreigners.
He's got a beard as well. He has a beard. Dark skin, dangerous stuff. And look, the actual scandal they've unearthed so far is that his son, who is Nigerian and maybe should have stuck to emails or whatever Nigerian guys do, he was working for a Cotecna, a Swiss company, that got a contract for the UN. He said that he'd left. By all accounts, he told his dad he'd left. The company told the UN that he'd left. Kofi Annan had no provable influence over this contract, and quite frankly, I know the guy. I don't think he's the type of thing he would bother messing in anyway. And this is the sort of sum total of his connection. What the Paul Volcker inquiry that is costing $60 million, which I think is a real scandal...
$60 million.
$60 million.
How do you spend $60 million in an inquiry?
Well, you employ ex-FBI agents expensively who go around the world and then get disappointed when you don't agree with them. They resign, like happened 2 weeks ago. You set up an office. You hire lawyers. You go into these things. The other thing that they found is that the former head of the Oil for Food program, Benon Saban, declared on his income returns to the UN, which, you know, a point of honesty, that over 4 years he got $160,000 from his aunt in Cyprus, who is now dead. So they haven't been able to prove that he didn't get this money. They found somebody in Cyprus who said, well, his aunt didn't have that much money, so it was, you know, a bit fishy. But this is hardly sort of standard to convince a jury anywhere else in the world. But, I mean, in Manhattan at the moment, you just have to say September 11th foreign and, you know, you've got yourself a lynch mob.
Well, $60 million to nab something over $160,000 seems like a pretty poor benefit.
Where the fun bit comes in is the complete absence of noise about the famous $8 billion on, I think it was January the 31st, the day of the Iraqi elections. The special inspector general appointed by George Bush to look into the Iraqi finances, the occupation finances, happened to mention that over $8 billion had gone missing and wasn't properly accounted for. Almost all of that $8 billion was oil for food money that the UN had handed over to the US occupation authorities under a proviso that the UN, a monitoring board composed of the UN, the International Monetary Fund and others, be allowed to check on how it was spent. The US has still not allowed them to go into the books 2 years later. These are the same people who are shouting that Congress must be allowed to, you know, Henry Hyde must sniff his sniveling little nose into every recess of the UN if he wants to. They're not allowing the UN inspectors and auditors to check what happened to this $8 billion. Now, there's a real scandal, $8 billion, and you never hear about it. This is not the oil for food scandal. And I'm going to be really heretical, because I think the UN people are underselling themselves. I think basically they've sort of washed their hands of this and just hope it goes away. Think of a program that Iraqis were dying. Children, hundreds of thousands of children were dying. In Madeleine Albright's famous phrase, it was a price worth paying. When she was asked, was it 500,000 Iraqi children died because of sanctions? Because of the Oil for Food program, by the time that the US invaded, 80% of Iraqis were getting their rations. The nutrition content of Iraqi diet had doubled during the term of the Oil for Food program. The other purpose of the program was to make sure he didn't get any money for weapons of mass destruction. Do you remember anything about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? There weren't any.
They're cleverly hidden in Syria, right?
Yeah. So here you have a program that, by any other terms, is a resounding success. It was so successful, the U.S. actually asked them to stay on for a year afterwards to carry on distributing the rations. And not just that, but if you check the figures, the power supply for Iraqis, the oil deliveries, were actually running higher under the Oil for Food program than they are now, after 2 years of U.S. occupation and benign investment of billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money. Where's the failure here? I mean, I really think the UN is underselling themselves. By any objective standards, the Oil for Food program was a huge success. And for a program involving, I think it's $65 billion, this, you know, to spend $60 million to find 160,000 missing and a wayward son of the Secretary General, I really think this is total disproportion.
Yeah, I saw a chart just the other day of electricity production in Iraq. It's been flat for like the last year or two, so it's really not going nowhere, despite the alleged expenditure of all this reconstruction money. It's a mystery. But what exactly is the claim? How much was stolen by whom out of this oil for food?
Exactly the claim. The big issue is, well, first of all, Saddam Hussein sold oil. They call it smuggled oil. He sold oil to the Jordanians. He sold oil to the Turks.
With the tacit approval of the United States.
Not the tacit approval, the explicit approval given every year in Congress. Congress each year approved the Secretary of State's determination that they should not put any heavy muscle on Turkey and Jordan for breaking the sanctions. This was reported in the Security Council. Everyone knew about it. The only time anyone got concerned was when the Syrians got in on the act. It was okay for the Jordanians and the Turks to buy oil, chief. But once Bashar al-Assad did the sort of rat jumping on a sinking ship thing and decided to kiss and make up with Saddam Hussein, that was when they first started shouting about it. So that's almost all of the alleged sums that Saddam Hussein got because of the Oil for Food program. Nothing to do with Oil for Food, nothing to do with the UN, known about by the United States, complete blessing by the West, that's the US and the UK, and the rest of the money was on double pricing on contracts, which was a couple of billion. And what Saddam was doing here was that because of the way the Security Council had set up this deal, all the UN did was act as the sort of the piggy bank. He could sell the oil to anyone he liked, as long as they put the money into a UN escrow account. And then they could he could buy the food supplies from whoever he wanted and draw that from the UN bank. So in after a year or two, he began to see opportunities, and there was a few percentages here and there on a big contract could make a lot of money siphoned off. The UN actually reported that. The UN inspectors reported this to the Security Council, which did nothing about it. They reported it to the Sanctions Committee. So, I mean, they've all sort of guilty of this, and they're all pointing their fingers in the direction of the UN. And I think one of the problems in the US is, of course, this happened under the watch of both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, so there's no particular percentage in the people at the time saying, yeah, boo, told you so, because they didn't. They were all guilty of at least, you know, tacit connivance in this. So they're quite happy to see Kofi Annan swing, because even supporters of the UN in the US, they really think that the UN's major role is to be a scapegoat and to be blamed for anything that we do that messes up.
Well, meanwhile, the UN has approval ratings in the polls about 25 or 30 points higher than George Bush's are right now.
Very interesting, because you'd never guess that. It was interesting in another context, is that public opinion in the U.S. is running 70 to 80% against the nomination of John Bolton. But you'd never get this in Washington. I mean, you know, the black helicopter crowd, the weird guy in Utah who thinks that jet contrails are poison streams being deposited by the U.N. over the United States. He's the guy who rules the roost in Congress. He's the one whose considered opinions are on top of the agenda.
Speaking with Ian Williams, a journalist who has covered the UN for many years, and here talking about that and other things, as well as the British election. The Bolton nomination, how's that being received around on East 42nd Street?
Well, it's considerably less than ecstasy, I think. Apocryphally, when Kofi Annan was asked if he'd make a statement at the standout, he said, "I'm expected to smile." you know, this guy, it's just so hideously inappropriate. I mean, the metaphors keep spinning off. I mean, he is to diplomacy what Jack the Ripper was to surgery. It's like appointing King Herod as head of UNICEF. It's like appointing Michael Jackson as head of UNICEF, except Michael likes children. You know, I mean, this is just so wildly inappropriate. And in a perverse sort of leftist way, you know, if I put my ultra-leftist cap on, I hope he gets through, because he will make it much more difficult to advance Bush foreign policy. He will provoke resistance. I mean, this guy does not do nice. Your big problem in the Security Council is how to sweet-talk the Chinese into not vetoing what you want. And so here you send somebody who's doesn't do sweet talk, is a paid lobbyist for Taiwan. Well, you know, and I actually agree with him on Taiwan. It should be independent, but that's a separate issue. But, you know, I am not the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and, you know, the Taiwan hasn't paid me. So on both counts, I think he is... it was interesting, Jack Straw, the much-reviled Foreign Secretary of Britain, apparently moved heaven and earth to make sure that John Bolton was not on any of the joint negotiating teams over Iran or Korea or Libya that the British were involved in. Because they knew, I mean, this guy does not do diplomacy.
Well, that's the point, from the Bush people's point of view, right? That he's supposed to go in there and shake things up and unleash a little creative destruction on the UN.
Well, he goes in, he kicks people in the shins, and they kick back. The US comes and says, by the way, we really, really want this operation in Haiti, say. And they say, up yours. Take a kick back. Why should we cooperate? Give us a good reason to. And John Bolton bristling his walrus-like moustache and banging his flippers together ain't going to cut the mustard.
By the way, what was the situation with the U.S. Paying its U.N. dues?
They're pretty much up to date, but, I mean, it's been too long. It's only been 2 or 3 years since they've been paying, and Henry Hyde and Norman Coleman and the others are already shouting for us to cut back again. I mean, you know, it's just, there are some things that never go away, you know.
What are there all these proposals floating around to expand the Security Council, maybe add a few seats, India, Brazil, what's happening with that?
They're a bit hogtied, and I think deservedly so. I think that I don't honestly believe that expanding the Security Council makes it more representative. Certainly not adding more permanent seats doesn't make it more representative. There's some merit, I think, in the other proposal to have 8 seats elected for 4-year renewable terms. Because the point about them is that they're elected, so those members have to represent the sort of constituencies, the regions that they come from. And I'm sorry, if you give someone like India or Brazil or Japan or Germany a permanent seat, Germany might be under European Union discipline, but the others, they will represent their national interest and nothing else. Whereas the proposals for an expansion which include elected seats, I think, make much more sense.
Elected seats with continuing the 5 having veto power? Or not?
Well, the point about that is you can't stop it. You know what I mean? It's sort of the 5 have a veto. And short of completely scrapping the UN Charter, which John Bolton would like, you're stuck with those 5 having a veto. The position is that most of the time they don't use it. It's only the United States actually abuses it. And that's something that, you know, it's up to the citizenry of the United States to take action against their government, to become aware of just how often and how much the veto is abused. But I honestly don't believe that you'd keep countries like China and the US in the UN without a veto. The British basically have decided that I think since this Labour government, and even before, they had pragmatically said that, you know, unless something was really essential British interests, vital existential ones, they wouldn't use it. The French, of course, think it's sort of some form of Gallic masculinity. You know, this is a sort of French phallus substitute for real power. So they're a bit weird about that. But you know, they're French.
Yeah, well, it's nice we can kick around the French. Did the British vote with the US on matters related to the Middle East?
This is one of the sad things about Robin Cook's departure. Right through Margaret Thatcher, other people, they voted along with everyone else. So the votes were pretty much 14-1 on almost every Middle East issue. And what's happened now is that the British under Jack Straw, well, it's really under Tony Blair, since, you know, he's the one calling the shots here, but Robin Cook could stand up to him when he was Foreign Secretary. They now basically abstain. If the US vetoes, the British abstain. Which is, you know, sort of not doesn't send a good signal. But Margaret Thatcher had big business interests in Saudi Arabia as well, so, you know, we're not just talking about unalloyed virtue here.
Well, there is not her holding hands with a Saudi prince, did we? Well, speaking of Blair and Straw and the gang, the British election today, polls are closed now, but I don't think we've heard any results from the exit polls. Maybe they're coming trickling in, but we haven't heard them here. What's your call?
Well, it looks very much, there's some very sort of, you know, Newton never sort of worked out the gravity for three different bodies. It's a bit like that, but it looks like Blair is, barring some sort of real miracle, is back in with a bigger majority than many of us will be happy with. I know many senior Labour figures who are actually praying for a smaller majority so that they could, he would be more amenable to backbench revolts and sort of principled abstentions. But
so the size of the majority is really important for the way he governs.
Yeah, very much so. Also, I mean, he's going to be like Tigger. He's going to get his bounce back for you Winnie the Pooh fans. If he's... He's been really battered over Iraq, and deservedly so, and all the polls show that, you know, what he did was extremely unpopular, he's mistrusted. So if he decides in a deluded way that this was a vote of confidence in him, we're in a bit of trouble, because most of the opinion polls seem to show that most people were voting for the Labour Party on the assumption that he was going to go and be replaced by Gordon Brown, in whom they seem to have a lot more trust. But there's another element here why the war is not important, and it actually was on the way down here, I was remembering. You know, when you elect a federal government in the United States, apart from sort of taxation, social security and war, the federal government doesn't, you know, it's not a big issue, but a British election, you're basically, it's almost like rolling together a city, county, state, and federal election. Because the national government deals with everything. It deals with education, it deals with health, it deals with transport. You know, on every level, who's in London is extremely important to you. Yeah, so, I mean, this is not like an election here where you vote for or against on a big issue, security or whatever. You're voting for all of those quality of life issues. You know, most people, when they voted for Bloomberg or not, they didn't think of the Middle East or, you know, sort of the nuclear defense as the big issue. They thought, is he going to make the streets safer? And so, you know, in a parliamentary system, especially a social democratic one like most of Western Europe, all of these issues are rolled into one. So it's a perfectly rational thing for a Brit who's totally opposed to the war to still want a Labour government as opposed to a Conservative one, you know? Especially since the Conservatives actually supported the war as well. So,
and since you don't vote directly for the big guy the way you do here, it's, what, 600 and some odd local elections that are being that really decide?
Yeah, the local percentage, I would say sort of 10%. If the local MP is a famous one, then the chances are he gets a big, much, you know, more people will turn out to vote on name recognition. But there's a fair amount of local recognition, but only about 10%. Most people vote by party. You're going to get some sort of anomalies. My favorite one to watch is the guy in Blackburn, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, who resigned because he said the British were too complicit in the American policy of dropping off people to be tortured by the Uzbeki government. And
the Uzbeki government is very accomplished.
Very good at torture. They boil people alive. I mean, these are our frontline allies against terrorism. These are tough cookies. You know, we send them, they boil them. And so that ambassador is actually running against Jack Straw. He's taken his redundancy payoff from the British government, and he's invested it in this election to overturn Jack Straw. I don't think he's going to succeed, but it's. You admire him and you've got to support him in a way for it.
Why was Blair so eager to support Bush in the war in Iraq? What's in it for Britain?
It wasn't so much Britain. Blair is... I think he was actually in favor of this war before Bush was, I suspect. This is part of his... He disliked evil dictators and he thought that people shouldn't allow Slobodan Milosevic, for example. And Saddam Hussein. So his big thing was that he thought that Saddam Hussein should go, and I think he actually thought he was the one that set George Bush on this. And the big mystery really is, why was George Bush so upset and fixated on Iraq? No one's ever explained it. I mean, it wasn't oil. I mean, ever since then, look at the price of oil now, thanks to that intervention.
It's been very good for oil company profits, though.
It has indeed, yes. But, I mean, in that case, you just bomb the oil fields. You don't go to the expense of occupying them. So, you know, it's a bit of a mystery. But basically, I think that impulse of his for sort of what he thought was a sort of politically correct intervention against an evil dictator. And then they looked for an excuse. And his excuse had to be one involving the UN, as all of those legal documents show, because that's what the British public parliament insisted on. And that was his big argument. This was implementing UN decisions about weapons of mass destruction. That was the flannel that he produced, without the technical difficulties. But once he'd sort of hitched himself to the Bush bandwagon, he was in trouble. I mean, his excuse, I think the phrase he used was he wanted a hand on the steering wheel. And as I said at the time, there ain't no steering wheel on a runaway train. And he didn't have his hand on the brake. I mean,
and,
you know,
the United States is not known for sharing the steering privileges anyway.
No, I mean, it was very, and, you know, I think the British establishment has been appalled at the American administration of the occupation. You know, the British and the State Department, I think, have been working together. But as we know, the Pentagon and the neocons ditched all of the State Department's advice. You just compare the little patch of southern Iraq that the British are running and compare that with the amount of mayhem that you're getting further north where the Americans are in. It's not that they're nicer down there, but the British, they're better trained in this, they're more used to it, and they've had their share of incidents. But also, Jeremy Greenstock, the British ambassador at the UN, he resigned after 6 months as Paul Bremer's deputy because... Now, I knew he wanted to go anyway as soon as it got hot, but, I mean, he just seems to have been horrified by what was happening there. There's this little thing about actually listening to people. So you send all of these people there who don't speak Arabic who shout, hey, you know, halt, and wonder why they don't. You know, you can just imagine if an Arab cop in the streets of New York shouted, "Kaf, stop," in Arabic, and how many people would stop?
Well, that's not the way they do things in Texas. Blair unusually has a kind of religious moral streak, unusually mm-hmm. for a British politician. How's that play?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, one of the interesting things about this election in Britain is the complete absence of anything about gays, anything about abortion, or pretty much anything about religion. I mean, he's got a moral streak which can appeal to people. Most British people don't like dictators, and they're quite prepared to see some forms of intervention to rescue people, far more so than, you know, Americans in that sense. Part of that is a sort of Second World War thing. You know, if you let these people carry on, there's no telling where it all goes. You know, we should have intervened in the Rhineland when Hitler first started getting stroppy. And it would have saved us being bombed to hell and all of those years of rationing.
Although a lot of the British upper class is rather fond of old Adolf.
Well, they were indeed, yes, it's of course, especially the Daily Mail, which is now sort of big on every other dictator in the world. So, I mean, he appeals to a streak. It's a moral streak rather than a religious one, even though in his case it's sort of, he claims religious roots. But there's a complete absence of that stuff. And religion in British politics is something that's practiced in private between consenting adults. You know, you don't bring it out in public.
We've only got like a minute left, but what would you expect from the third Blair administration?
It's worrying. It really depends on the size of his majority. And, you know, I think he's learned his lesson. You're not going to see any more Iraqs. I mean, it's just been too costly in every way. His problem now is going to be just how much money they might have pumped into the economy in anticipation of the election that they now have to pay for. You know, there's nothing like the American-style deficit, but, you know, there was definitely a sort of sound of the cash registers ringing as they emptied them out in the run-up to the election. But the economy is going to have a little bit of a hiccup. I think it'll be going on, and it's very sort of slow but steady. One of the reasons why Gordon Brown's been doing all this stuff, by the way, is Labour governments are mesmerised from their experience in the 60s and 70s when Harold Wilson famously referred to the gnomes of Zurich. He'd probably be accused of some form of racism now. But
not against Swiss.
Okay. Gnomes. Yeah. But, I mean, basically, if the financiers, including the City of London, deliberately worked over every Labour government that came in on ideological grounds. So what Gordon Brown and part of the new Labour project, which actually makes sense as opposed to the ideological, weird, neo-Thatcherite stuff, has been to sort of appease the city and persuade them that Labour can govern responsibly and run the economy better. And for 8 years, the economy's risen. They've introduced a minimum wage, which is now not even a contentious issue. The British minimum wage is now double the US minimum wage. So, and of course, free healthcare comes thrown in for everyone anyway. So, you know, there are lots of reasons why people are feeling better off in Britain. But there's also a feeling that this government could and should have done a lot more, could have been a lot more adventurous. It would have got a lot more support for it.
Well, thank you for joining us, Ian Williams. Ian Williams, British in origin, but now living in New York City, and journalist covering the UN and also the homeland. You had no responsibility for those grenades in front of the British consulate today, right?
No. Oh, you forgot to plug my next book.
The next book. Well, there's time for that.
Okay.
Rum, A Social and Sociable History, coming
from... Of the Real Spirit of 1776.
Forthcoming from Nation Books in August.
August, yes. Yo-ho-ho.
You'll be back here on, well, I hope some samples also.
Of both, yeah.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'm not sure when I'll be back here, but fundraising begins next week, so the schedule is somewhat unpredictable this moment. This being Karl Marx's birthday, let's go out with this rendition of the Internationale from Alistair Hewlett.
Arise, ye ones, from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital at us best. The Internationale unites the human race. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital at us best. The Internationale unites the human race. No more deluded by reaction, on tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strife action, they'll break ranks, they'll fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to the fray, they soon shall hear the bullets flying, we'll shoot the generals on our own side. Us of comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us